Welcome back to another episode of Hooked on Score. I'm your host, Rick Urban. With me today, we have Dominic Schur. Dominic is the composer for the Netflix series, The Serpent. Dominic, score, it's a lot of, I want to say gamelan type of sounds, a lot of metallic vibraphone type of mallet instruments, and a little bit of synth work in there. This series stars Tahar Rahim off of his success from The Mauritanian, and it is based upon, well, I will let Dominic talk a little bit about the story and everything like that, but I want to say hello to Dominic. Dominic, how are you?
Hello, I'm very good, thank you.
Where are you joining us from?
So I'm from London,
okay.
UK. So, and this is, as you know, pretty much the rest of the world, I'm forced to work from home at the moment. So you're seeing me or hearing me from my home, where I've been working from for probably the last, for the last year, exactly a year now. Yeah.
So. Thanks so much for joining us today. This series is already streaming on Netflix. Charles Sobhraj, he was impersonating a gem dealer, is that right?
He was impersonating all sorts of people, but gem dealers was one of his favorites, yes.
And it's sort of a true crime story in the vein, would you say, of kind of like the Johnny Depp movie Blow?
Yeah, I mean, potentially, but, you know, it's even crazier. It's one of those instances where truth is stranger than fiction, really. This series actually is incredibly accurate historically, visually as well. And the things that happened are incredible, really. And what this guy got away with and what he did is really unbelievable. And it's kind of extreme, but fascinating at the same time.
And he was kind of a master of forgery, is that right? That's why he was able to be able to move about
and
so freely.
Deception, yes. I mean, he was an expert in passport forgery, and so he traveled on dozens of different passports under different names. He and his accomplices, and then he managed to kind of charm people so they trusted in him. And then he misused that trust and ultimately killed a lot of them or robbed them and drugged them.
To score this, your instrumentation choice, it's kind of a little bit reminiscent of Steve Reich, and a little bit, it is set in the 70s, so there's a little bit of that kind of sound in there too. Can you talk a little bit about the score?
Yeah, I mean, the Steve Reich influence, Steve Reich and Philip Glass, and that's actually in there almost as a 1970s influence. Yeah. You know, I wanted, you know, it would have been too easy to do this as a sort of cliched 1970s, as if you were kind of watching a documentary about the 1970s and you have some funky wah-wah guitar and stuff like that, you know, and it just would, I think that kind of nostalgia would make it cozy in a way, which this shouldn't be, you know. And of course, at the same time, it had to feel modern. And so I wanted to pick some interesting, more forward-looking elements from the 70s and then merge those to create a modern score in a way. So as you're saying, the kind of, because the Steve Reich influence and instrumentation is in there because Steve Reich and Philip Glass, they started to look at sort of Eastern spiritualism as well in the 70s. You know, that was influential on their music, and Reich was looking into gamelan music and all that, you know. So, and also, yeah, the sort of connected spirituality, and in a way this parallels the story of this series as well, because it's a lot of Western young people from Europe, from the US, go to the Far East or Southeast Asia to find, you know, because they're interested in Buddhism, and they're kind of, they, you know, it was sort of with the flower power years afterwards, the hippies, and so that was the hippie trail. And so, you know, some of them wanted to go to a monastery in Nepal, or they wanted to study Buddhism. So in a way, the music, I think, could kind of reflect that in a sort of modernist way, this search for spirituality.
And most of it is set in Bangkok, or it travels throughout Asia?
It's set probably half of the time in Bangkok, and then it's in Hong Kong, in Kathmandu, in India, in New Zealand, in New York, in Paris quite a lot.
So you're kind of following Subraj's journey throughout all these things. And he sort of would kill people just to get their information, right, to travel about and almost forge their identity a little bit, and their money, obviously, yeah.
The money, the traveler checks.
Have any experience over there? Have you ever been over there and kind of heard that music in person before, or did you just sort of study before this?
So obviously we wanted to also bring in this kind of Asian vibe to it, but without being kind of his musicologically accurate necessarily, you know. But so it's just something that takes you on to a journey. So, and the series was being mostly filmed in Bangkok. So I went out there and spent a few weeks there recording. I was in a sort of great studio, and we recorded a lot of percussion and, sort of mallet type stuff, you know, these kind of marimbas that they've got there called Ranat Ek, etc. So, and I had some really good players. So then that became a kind of library of material that I could create other things from, you know, because obviously, you know, sort of music in Thailand, that kind of music is very, it's happy music, you know. It's not really music for a thriller, for a hard-hitting thriller like this. So I needed to take that stuff and put it through a process to make it appropriate for this kind of feel we wanted. But it was exciting, and it was exciting to be, you know, I could visit the set as well, and could, you know, hang out with the cast and blah blah. So it was a nice way to get immersed in the project as well.
Wow, that's not an opportunity that a lot of composers have. Why were they so into that for this project? Did they just feel it was important?
It was kind of my suggestion, because I did a similar thing a couple of years ago for a show called The Widow, which was an Amazon show with Kate Beckinsale. And that was set in the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, in Africa. And so, but they were shooting in South Africa. So again, I went out there to record a whole lot of material, a lot of vocals for that project. And it was a real success. You know, it sounded great. And so I thought, this is actually maybe quite a new and interesting way of doing soundtracks, really. You know, sort of to take me out of my comfort zone of the nice London studios and go out there, you know, for a while, and then we can always bring the stuff back again and overdub our things here. So
there is a lot of vocals on this as well. Can you talk a little bit about that? Did you use one particular vocalist throughout, or are there different people on here?
Well, there is mainly sort of chant-like.
It's kind of like the Gladiator style of vocal.
There is one track. Yes, there is. That's right. There is one track that's more like a soprano, and she is Eliza Skelton. She's in Brighton, England, and then there is. I wanted to get that sort of sound of like monks, in a monastery, and for this I wanted really super deep voices, you know, which in classical music is called basso profundo, kind of extra low bass, where you know, it's Eastern Europe and Russia is where there's specialists in that, you know. So I got that recorded remotely in Bulgaria, those low basses, which was exciting. And then in Thailand, I recorded the more kind of chant-like vocals, you know, because also when you are in anywhere in and you go to those Buddhist Thai Buddhist monasteries, you know, there is like serious chanting going on almost all the time, you know, so that's very common there, and so I wanted to incorporate that, but kind of in a more rhythmical way. So it's almost, and some of the chants I did like percussion. In fact, it sounds like percussion in the end. You wouldn't be able to tell that it was actually vocal. So it's almost like a vocal percussion thing.
And was that something you recreated, or were you actually recording the monks in the monasteries?
Not in the monasteries, no.
Yeah, okay.
No, that was in the studio.
Okay,
the studio.
Cool. Yeah, that's kind of an amazing process when you think about all these different peoples that music is such a big part of their life that you wouldn't really think about a monk being, you know, a very active musician, you know, obviously back in the Middle Ages and everything like that, but even still today, they spend a lot of their day dealing with music. And, you know, we really don't think about that. We think about the performers and the composers and things like that. But different parts around the world, music's even bigger part of their life than I would say it is ours.
I guess so. But I mean, you know, it's a lot of it is quite basic as well. It's more like they're kind of very repetitive lines. You know, it's a bit like, you know, plain chant in Europe 900 years ago or something, you know. So but I'm obviously, you know, what I wanted to do for this is a much more it's a more refined and sort of translated thing, you know. So again, you know, we weren't really that it wasn't really about geographic accuracy, you know. It was about doing something unique and interesting.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about your background. How did you get started as a musician?
I, you know, like a lot of people, you know, you learn instruments. I learned the flute when I was young, and then the piano, and then I started to learn to improvise. I was very interested in synthesizers, so I bought some cheap synth on the flea market in Zurich, where I grew up, and then. But I was always deeply fascinated by film and film music. So And I really wanted to make film music from quite an early, you know, when I was a teenager already. So, but obviously I couldn't really score anyone's film. So I made my own films, and primarily for the purpose of scoring, scoring them. So I did kind of, they eventually became elaborate sort of adaptations of literature and things like that. And then I did sort of, I had a Polymoog synth at the time, which was a kind of vintage synth, but a very large instrument with a big sound. And so, and I guess I was sort of influenced by Werner Herzog at the time, and also the sort of music that he used, you know, which was a lot of kind of German krautrock type stuff. So I was doing stuff like that really. And, and then I came to England. Not immediately. I went to Hamburg first because I also had a band. And we went to Hamburg because we wanted to make rock music, and we knew that the Beatles made it big in Hamburg. So that's why we went to Hamburg.
Follow the same path, right?
So then I was okay, but I still actually really wanted to do film music. So I came to England and studied film, and then did a lot of film music and things continued from there, you know, just from doing short films, and then they become longer, etc.
Said you grew up in Zurich. What is the Swiss film scene like, or at least when you were there, what you can remember? I don't really know much about the films of Switzerland. What is the film industry like there?
Well, you know, it's a lot of, there is no major studios there, of course. It's more kind of art house films. And you know, there was good Swiss films that did internationally well, and you know, some of them won some Oscars. And then there was also, you know, people like Jean-Luc Godard and Bob. You know, they were still he was still making films. He's Swiss and French and based in Switzerland at the time. You know, so it was a kind of more art house outlook really from there. And the sort of mainstream cinema we just sort of had in the cinemas, but I guess for me that was less of a sort of what I was looking towards. You know, I was more, as I said, the Werner Herzog and all that, you know. So that was, you know, but it wasn't, you know, when I came to England, I was 20, you know, it was for me a lot more exciting because it was a lot more international, and things were happening on a different scale.
And so when you kind of transitioned from playing in a band to starting to create your own films for the purpose of scoring, how did you sort of transition into these bigger projects? Was there a pivotal moment where you got a big gig or something like that?
Yeah, I mean,
as a composer.
Well, it's, you know, you start, it's quite nice when you start initially small, you know, you just write for, you know, I was doing for a long time, I was just writing for string quartet for, also I had friends who had a quintet and I was just writing for them basically. And so, and it's quite a nice way of building up. And then I started to do the first orchestral short film scores, And you sort of, you know, so then the things I learned from doing the quartet, I could apply to the bigger ensemble, but it wasn't like a huge orchestra yet. And then I got a sort of first feature film that was orchestral. We went over to Hungary, actually, to record that at a time, which was, that's quite common now, but it was more of an adventure at that time. It kind of, you know, built up from that. At some point then, but that was quite a bit later, I started. So I was doing mainly kind of art house films, you know, but and then I started doing a series for British TV that did very well. It was Agatha Christie's Marple, which was, you know, there was every 4 weeks I was recording an orchestra for years, you know. So wow. And I always had the chance to try out new things and to, you know, it was really style-wise kind of the opposite of what something like The Serpent is, you know. This was kind of very English pastoral sort of crime music, you know. But in a way, you know, you learn a lot doing things like that, and it was fun as well.
Yeah, a lot of composers, especially these days, don't have that experience where I think a lot of composers that sort of grew up in the old studio system days where every TV show on NBC had its own, you know, orchestral score to it, and they had that funding. You know, I hear Bruce Broughton, for instance, talk a lot about when he was scoring different TV shows, he would just try stuff every week. It's like, oh, let's just try a woodwind for this entire TV show and see what I can do with that. And you get to kind of learn using this orchestra, but it's just too expensive these days.
Fun, you keep it fun like that as well, because exactly that was my rule, you know. Each time try something new that shouldn't really work, maybe, or, you know, let's add some, you know, whatever, these kind of combination of horns as well, which shouldn't really fit into that kind of thing, or etc., you know. So and you can always improvise if things don't work, you know. You can always find a way around it, you know. But you know, then they do, or you make them work, and it's exciting.
So how did the relationship with this project come about? Did you work with the director previously, or is this the first time working together?
Yes, I worked with Tom Shanklin, the director, before on quite a few projects. We did The Missing together, which you had over there as well. That was, you know, Starz production, and then Ripper Street as well. The City and the City. We've done quite a few things together, yes. So, wow. And then with the producers as well, Mammoth Screen, they're, in the meantime, they have now become, maybe they're kind of one of the biggest UK production companies. So I have worked with them quite a bit in the past as well. Ooh. So it was nice. It was a familiar team, which was nice.
Yeah. And I mean, having the opportunity to go over to Bangkok and everything like that, that's, you know, that was a good suggestion on your part. I think all composers should start doing that. Just whenever you have a project, just float the idea to producers. Say, hey, you know, I see you're filming in Hawaii for 3 weeks. Maybe I should learn about the Hawaiian culture a little bit over there.
You know, I have tried this in the past as well. I remember there was one of the Agatha Christie's Marple that was Murder in the Caribbean, it was called. They actually filmed it in South Africa. And again, I said, I should really go there, shouldn't I? But it didn't work out that time, but it worked out this time, yeah.
So you have been nominated for an Emmy, is that correct?
For The Missing.
The Missing, yes. Okay, great. And that was on Starz for, I think, over here. When you have something like that, how do you transition from that music project to project? How do you put your, obviously with this one, you were kind of, imagine you found yourself, your headspace when you were over in Bangkok as far as setting up for the project?
Well, even before, you know, I had, because I with Tom Shankland, the director, we started working on The Missing, that basically I do a lot of the music while they're shooting or even before they're shooting. So there is, they don't have to use, you know, what's called temp music, which is temporary music that they put on the film, and then essentially the composer sort of replaces that. So we wanted to avoid that.
Yeah.
Because it allows you to be more original and bolder as well. Because then you can really try some stuff that you think like, well, maybe it's going to work. And, you know, so...
So a lot of this music was written before even production happened.
Well, some of it, yes.
Or simultaneously.
Simultaneously, because then I get the rushes or I get their sort of weekly assemblies, and then I get a feel for it as well.
Wow. Yeah, that's, again, a process not a lot of people get to participate in. Oftentimes, composers are brought in so late in the project that everything is done and
exactly.
Kind of have to...
Yeah. I mean, it's more time consuming for the composer to do it this way, you know, because I then spend, you know, time up front. It doesn't have to be full time, but ultimately, yes, you know, of course it means also you're writing music that is going to land on the cutting room floor. Mm. So you have to be prepared to spend more time on it and then maybe just overall to take on less projects, you know, but then you can be more original.
Yeah. And you can really sort of take a deep dive into each project. It's not just something kind of on the slate in the afternoon. It's like, oh, well, yeah, I have to finish the score for The Serpent today. And then in the afternoon, I'll go have dinner kind of thing. So,
yeah. And then, you know, also because what then happened last year with COVID and, you know, the whole post-production or slow down. And I actually suddenly had more time, because normally, you know, then once we are in post-production, you know, sometimes I have like only 5 days to do an episode, etc., you know, so but suddenly there was a bit of time to think about things, which was this is the first time in my career that in anyone's career, I think, where that happened, really, because they couldn't finish all the post-production because the ADR, you know, the dialogue re-recording with the actors, because the actors were spread all over the world and they were at home, you know, they couldn't go to the studios, etc. They couldn't do the mixing, they couldn't do the grading. Mm. And I was just sort of, but actually it allowed me to kind of rethink some of the things and improve some of the things we already had, and I think it actually really paid off. It was nice. I think I will, I mean, despite, of course, you know, it's a tragic year, 2020. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, it was kind of creatively quite gratifying for me.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have experienced a lot of personal growth over last year in things that they probably didn't expect to have time to do. You know, it's almost like everybody got their rainy day list. I don't know if you're like me, you have a list of things to do and I'm going to go through that sample library eventually when I have time or something like that. Or I'm going to watch these movies when I have time, and you never have time. And everybody kind of got that time last year. So... Again, this series streaming on Netflix, The Serpent. And do you have any other projects coming up that you can talk about here, or is everything kind of shut down for the moment?
No. I mean, I'm working on a new series of Baptiste, which is the spin-off from The Missing with the same detective. So that's now the second series, and we are just in the middle of that. And then I'm working on an Italian set Netflix show called Luna Park. And then I'm also working on a new HBO and some UK co-producers show that I think I probably should not be talking about yet. But it's exciting. I can maybe say it's got a great cast. It's got a very well-known cast. And
That's why I always preface that question with, can you talk about it here?
I think I can say that it's being shot in Australia at the moment. And so normally, as we just talked about, you know, I would go say like, oh, I absolutely have to go to Australia and record some material there. But this is not really the year for traveling. So I think it's not.
I don't know. Australia is one of the places you would. I mean, it's pretty much non-existent right now in Australia.
Once you're there, it's great. I mean, I'm in touch with the director at the moment. He says it's great. I can, you know, they're not. In where they are, they don't have to wear masks. He said, oh, he can hug people and things. You know, that's like, we haven't done that in a year, you know. So I think it's once you're there, but, you know, you have to quarantine and then you have to, quarantine coming back, all that. So it's too complicated.
Yeah, I'm still just getting comfortable with the fist bump that everybody's used, or the elbow touch that everybody's using for greetings around here. So... Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dominic. Again, this series, The Serpent, on Netflix, the composer is Dominic Scherer. And do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
Well, no, it's been really nice talking to you, Rick. And it's going to be, I think it's actually it's a good series. And I'm not saying that because I did the music and I want to say it's good, you know, but it's actually, it's an unbelievable story, but it's also very interestingly made. It's quite a demanding watch. So people, when they start on the first episode, they go like, wow, God, this is complicated, because it jumps back and forth in time. And then I think by the second and third episode that, you know, everyone understands the format, you know, and then they are totally addicted.
And the again, Tahar Rahim, this is, I'm just being introduced to him through The Martinian, but it seems like he's going to take over Hollywood for the next couple of years.
With his talent and, you know, on The Serpent, this was a really difficult part, I think, you know, and it's fascinating how he played it, you know.
And it seems like these series, I don't know, you get a chance to really... get to know the actor. I think I'm kind of thinking of The Queen's Gambit and everything like that, where you have these Netflix series rather than just a 90-minute movie. When you get 8 episodes, you know, you can really follow this story and follow this. I just watched the Zack Snyder cut of Justice League, the 4-hour one, the other night, and it's just such a different presentation with that much time to present the story. So I think it's, I don't know, I'm kind of a fan of these, of the longer type of series. I think as a society, we've been moving towards TV from movies.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was, you know, that's, partly why it is now so successful, and more people, I think, watching these series than they watch feature films now. Yeah. And it's partly, I think, it just sort of happened because sort of cinema came out of that. It was a kind of evening entertainment at the theater, you know, after, you know, seeing just stage shows, and then it was the movies in the cinema. And then they started to adapt books, you know, for the screen, which was, you know, into 90 minutes or 2 hours. And most of the time, it was always a disappointment for everyone, wasn't it? Because there was just so much missing always. And I think finally now with these sort of eight-part series, those adaptations actually work because there is enough time to go into some of the details, to have the subplots.
Yeah, absolutely. Is the soundtrack available streaming right now? It is. Okay.
Yes, that's it's streaming it.
So you can go and listen
on all platforms.
I really enjoyed talking to you, Dominic. Again, the music is available to stream on all your streaming platforms. So I want to thank you guys again for being with us this week. I want to remind our listeners to check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/hookedonscore. And thank you again, Dominic, for being here. We will see you next week on another episode of Hooked on Score.
All right, everyone. That's our show. Bye.